I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump tweeted on Wednesday that transgender persons would no longer be welcome to serve in the U.S. military. Let me quote his tweets. He said, "After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail." The next day, yesterday, General Joseph Dunford, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told service members there would be no changes to the current policy until the defense secretary receives a directive from the president and issues a new policy. He added, "In the meantime, we will continue to treat all our personnel with respect." Trump's transgender ban was a surprise to military leadership, a shock to transgender troops and to members of Congress as well. And we want to get response from our two guests. Joining us by telephone is Sherry Swakowski, retired Army colonel, served as the Human Resources Director for the Wisconsin National Guard in the Rocky Mountain region of the U.S. Forest Service. She transitioned from male to female in the military. She is vice chair of the Fair Wisconsin Education Fund, also a member of the Wisconsin ACLU Board of Directors. Sherry Swakowski, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me this morning, and I do have to make one adjustment here in that I did not transition while serving. I was prohibited because the policy hadn't changed yet.
Oh, fair enough.
My transition was after.
Oh, after. I appreciate that correction. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Heath Fogg Davis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, member of the Philadelphia Mayoral LGBT Affairs Committee, wrote a book called Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? He's a trans man of color and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Heath, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sherry, let me get your response to the president's tweets earlier this week.
Yes. Woke up to my phone blowing up, and after I had some time to actually read the tweets, it started sinking in. But my reaction was, or multiple reactions, but I was shocked that our commander-in-chief would turn his back on 15,000 individuals who are currently wearing the uniform, 15,000 individuals who put their lives on the line daily to keep us free and safe.
And have you been hearing from people, trans soldiers or Marines that you know? As you said, your phone was blowing up.
Yes, I have heard from many. And, you know, while they may be disappointed, they continue to do their job. I mean, they're getting up every day since, just like they did before the tweets were announced, and they're putting on their uniform and their gear, and they're going out and they're doing their jobs to keep us safe and free. We have some pretty talented folks out there. They are commanders, they are drill sergeants, they are special operators. There are transgender pilots and submariners and doctors, and as well as Marines and infantry officers like me, and they'll continue to do their jobs until told otherwise.
What do you make of the fact that the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I quoted him, his response to the president's tweet policy?
Yes, well, I think rightly so when he said that there is no change to policy, and three tweets does not a policy make. So there are many things that we don't know about this, any implementation instructions that come down, even the legality of it. So there's going to be more coming up in more discussion, I'm sure.
You're not a military person, Heath. What's your response?
Sure. So a couple of things. I think just going to the text of the tweet itself, the two claims about that this having transgender people serve openly in the military is disruptive, and also that it's too expensive in terms of healthcare costs. Both of those two statements are really unfounded. The language of disruption has been used in the past. It was the exact same narrative with respect to don't ask, don't tell, with gay men and lesbians serving openly in the military. The same has been said about women in the military, African Americans, going way back historically. So that term, disruptive, really, to me, smacks of about prejudice. It's a sort of a term that is standing in for an argument that doesn't exist. And then just to the medical costs, the percentage, the amount of money that would need to be spent on transgender healthcare would be incredibly small compared to all the other things that the military covers in its health benefits. And we see evidence of this. A lot of Fortune 500 companies, big universities, Penn, Temple now, have included transgender healthcare in their policies because it costs them so little and it seems like the right thing to do. So just from a practical standpoint, the statements are illogical or unfounded.
In fact, let me quote a little bit from Rand Corporation that looked exactly, Heath, at some of the things you were saying. This was commissioned by the Pentagon to take a look at this, the effect of having transgender people serving in the military, finding that the costs are 0.1% of the whole military budget, and that most foreign military commanders certainly were encouraged by the kind of inclusion or cohesion, and that they were concerned that a policy like this could force recruits away or make people not want to serve in the military.
Yeah, exactly. And this goes to another issue that I wanted to raise, which is that it's not clear that Trump or a lot of other people have really thought through what transgender identity looks like, sounds like, entails. So we have this term that's being used. Transgender people can look and sound many different ways, and the diversity within that umbrella category is pretty tremendous. And so just the sort of the logistics again of if you were going to go after and try to, even figure out who's transgender in the military right now, some people serving in the military identify as trans may not look to be trans to other people. Others may. I mean, so there's a whole sorts of, logistical issues about how you would even go about enforcing this kind of exclusion.
Sure, Swakowski, let me go back to you because this study by Rand also said that transgender people are twice as likely to serve in the military than non-transgender people. How do you understand that?
Yes, that number or that data are from a study that was done back in 2011, and the estimate was actually made by the Williams Institute at the UCLA out of California. And I believe probably some of that is due to the fact, especially with male to females, like myself. I mean, when I graduated high school, I ended up joining not only the Wisconsin National Guard, but the local county sheriff's department. And probably in the back of my mind was the thought that being in a male-dominated environment and profession would help me deal with these feelings and make them go away. And obviously that never happened.
And it was a place to learn that or to test yourself? Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, to see if there was, if I could be changed, perhaps. And that wasn't about to happen.
Do you want to respond to that, Heath?
Sure. I'm so glad that, Sherry, you brought that up because it goes to a point that I try to stress in my book and my work, and which is that gender transition occurs within this larger, gender binary that affects us in so many ways in our society. So there are differences between, my experience as somebody who transitioned from female to male and Sherry's experience going from male to female. And then there are people who identify as non-binary or gender fluid, somewhere in between. So the diversity there, but the we're affected by the gender binary just as everybody else is. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, in the book, I'm pushing us to question why we invoke gender in the first place in our policies. So that the issue here kind of speaks to a larger question for me about how relevant is gender in the military itself in a number of different ways. So there's like a larger question there, I think.
Well, Sherry, do you have any thoughts about that? And it seems that the military is where we, if not test, where certain civil rights issues get either tested or implemented.
Well, very true. I mean, our military has been on the cutting edge of change for decades. We talked about some of it, but the desegregation of the military came actually 20 years before the Civil Rights Act. Mm-hmm. The integration of women, and then things like allowing gay and lesbians to serve openly in 2011, opening the jobs to everyone in 2016, and allowing trans people to serve openly in June 30th of last year. And each time we find that there have been critics, and those critics have warned us about decreased readiness and cohesion, and each time those critics have been proven wrong. So it's because of these changes we have the best fighting force in the world. It's not despite them.
You know, I read the president's tweet, and he said that he had consulted with his military in issuing these tweets. But, and I'll go back to you, Sherry Swakowsky, only because you're a retired Army colonel, but what we're hearing from the military is that he did not consult them. What do you make of that?
Yes, everything that I have heard leads me to believe that there was no consultation with any generals. If he did have consultation with generals, those generals have opted not to come forward. So from the very first part of the tweet, if you know, that information is not accurate, then what about the rest of the tweet? And we already talked about the fallacy of the concern about the medical costs and the disruption. I think probably the only disruption that's occurring is the disruption now in the military because of the tweets and because of the sacred trust that was broken between the commander-in-chief and the service members in the field.
This is sort of asking you to imagine something that we don't really know is going to happen or not. But it's just interesting to hear from the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff whether there will be, Sherry Swakowsky, some kind of pushback of if this policy then goes to the defense secretary.
Yes, and I think there are a lot of questions about how this would be accomplished, and I'm very pleased to see the bipartisan support coming out of the Congress, particularly from the Republicans, who I think get that the fact that anyone who is currently serving in uniform should be allowed to serve in uniform and should not be told that they have to take that off.
Well, we are going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We're talking about some tweets earlier this week from the president that transgender people would no longer be allowed to serve or enlist in the U.S. military in any capacity. Talking with Sherry Swakowsky, a retired Army colonel who served in the Wisconsin National Guard and the Rocky Mountain region of the U.S. Forest Service. Also with us, Heath Fogg Davis, associate professor of political science at Temple University, also a member of the Philadelphia Mayoral LGBT Affairs Committee, and he's got a new book called Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We've got two clips to play after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're just joining us, we are talking about the president's tweets earlier this week that transgender people can no longer serve or enlist in the U.S. military. Our guests are Heath Fogg Davis and Sherry Swakowsky. Let me play a clip from candidate Trump. He was speaking in New Hampshire. This was following the Pulse nightclub shooting that was in Orlando back in June of 2016.
Ask yourself, who is really the friend of women and the LGBT community? Donald Trump with actions or Hillary Clinton with her words? I will tell you who the better friend is, and someday I believe that will be proven out bigly. And by the way, the LGBT community is just what's happened to them is just so sad. And to be thinking about where their policies are currently with this administration is a disgrace to that community, I will tell you right now.
At the White House briefing on Wednesday, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders answered reporters' questions about President Trump's announcement on Twitter that he would ban transgender people from serving in the military.
Why did he decide to do this, given that during the campaign he had declared that he would protect the rights of transgender individuals? He said he would be better on this issue than Hillary Clinton. Now he's turned the clock back on this issue regarding the military.
The president has a lot of support for all Americans and certainly wants to protect all Americans at all times. The president's expressed concern since this Obama policy came into effect, but he's also voiced that this is a very expensive and disruptive policy, and based on consultation that he's had with his national security team, came to the conclusion that it erodes military readiness and unit cohesion, and made the decision based on that.
So, Heath, what do you make of what was said on the campaign and what was done this week?
Yeah, I think I was skeptical, and I think a lot of people in the LGBTQ community were skeptical of that comment during the campaign. And also, he described himself as a friend to the LGBT committee community, but it wasn't backed up with any kind of substantive statement about the sort of the policies that he would support, that, you know, that civil rights issues that affect the community. And I think we see in Trump an example of, you know, when it's conducive to his business goals, he's perfectly fine supporting the community. But then when it comes to things like actual civil rights legislation, it's not clear to me that he's really thought through these issues a lot. And it's clear right now that they can sort of eviscerate, disappear into thin air because there was never any strong commitment to real issues.
Your book is titled Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? I mean, that's an issue for a larger discussion. Mm-hmm. But are you asking us to think beyond the kind of male-female binary view that I think so many people have?
Yeah, so this is a question that I wish that we would ask more frequently. The presumption, the widespread presumption, is that gender matters in a lot of different policies. Everything from the forms that we fill out to the bathrooms that we use, going on and on and on. The military is a really interesting institution to think about this question with. Gender has been deemed relevant in the military in the way that it's structured, and Sherry could speak more to that. But I think that sometimes gender matters, but a lot of times it doesn't. And when it does matter, we should have to make the arguments and defend the policies. And that involves a definition of gender and sex and what those terms mean. There's a lot of confusion right now in our society about what those mean. What does it mean, biological sex, legal sex? And then this goes into transgender discrimination, where that's actually a form of discrimination that affects a lot more people than just people who self-identify as trans. It affects gender nonconforming people of all genders.
Sherry, you mentioned the fact that, and you wrote about this in the Washington Post, about your struggles with your identity growing up and also serving in the military. Help us understand what those struggles are, because I think for a lot of people, they just do not understand how someone can feel that they are, you know, they are the wrong sex.
Yes. I mean, we're learning more about being transgender only because the medical and scientific community has come about and recognized this as being a medical disorder, a medical condition. And every medical condition is worthy of treatment.
Sure.
So I knew from a very young age, probably the age of 5. Going on from there, it was more about protecting myself, protecting my family. And so I was living the Army values, and that required me to deeply suppress my authenticity and my feelings of being a girl in order to be the best leader I could be for my soldiers.
And coming out or realizing to yourself who you were, how did that change you?
Yes. Well, that took about, five full decades.
I believe you. Yes, go ahead.
Before I finally shared my secret with anyone. And at that point, I decided I need to start living authentically and live up to my own expectations instead of the expectations of others. And so I did that while I was a government contractor at the Army's Force Management School at Fort Belvoir. Transitioned, I was promptly fired for my efforts. And shortly thereafter, probably 4 months later, was hired into the Pentagon as an analyst and served there for 2.5 years. And my experience at the Pentagon, in which many would consider an extremely conservative environment, was entirely positive. Mm. And it was positive because I was known for the skills I brought to the table and my abilities to do the job. And if we do that on the civilian side, we obviously can do that on the military side.
Heath, what's your story?
It's interesting. So I transitioned a little bit later in life, so at the age of 38, and I'm 46 now. And I can relate a little bit to what Sherry's talking about authenticity. But I also know in working with a lot of trans people that there are a whole wide range of narratives. And so I think the paradox of the medicalization of transgender identity in order to get healthcare is that it goes into this narrative of correction. I was born in the wrong body and I made a correction. Let's correct your identity documents. Let's make these corrections. And that's a story that is sort of imposed on people who identify as trans, and it doesn't necessarily resonate. And so, some people are gender fluid or non-binary who don't feel like they are fit into one of these categories perfectly. So that's just a conundrum with the sort of the medicalization, and also the legal narrative also requires that the identity be a discrete and immutable characteristic, which is interesting to think about as well.
As you were talking, I was thinking about when we find out if someone's having a baby, we say, is it a boy, is it a girl? Sometimes even if we're walking our dog and we say, is it a boy or a girl? I mean, that is the sort of default, yeah, I think, that many of us, I would include myself, operate out of.
Yes, yes. And I think it's one thing to do this socially, but it's another thing to do this when it comes to policymaking. So I think that gender does matter to a lot of us personally and even socially. And so I'm not saying that we should get rid of gender altogether. I don't think it's possible or something we should necessarily do. But I think that there's reason to be cautious and skeptical about invoking gender in written policies, the military included.
I mean, could this be sort of a moment of transition for all of us, or even education as we learn more about this?
I hope so. And I hope that maybe Trump can kind of learn as well, because I think we're at a point in our culture where people are familiar with the term transgender. But again, there's a lack of understanding about what that means. A lot of people think that they can easily visually identify somebody who's trans. I'm somebody who just sort of is a short guy with glasses, and I don't encounter a lot of transgender discrimination, to be honest, because people don't assume that I am. So there's an education that has to happen about who we are and the immense diversity.
Sure, I'm going to give you the last word. Any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
Two things. First of all, quality people in uniform is what makes our military the greatest fighting force this planet has ever seen. And we have the best quality because we avail ourselves of the entire gender spectrum. To choose on other than military qualifications is social policy, and that has no place in the military. Lastly, I would say that the military has taught us to fight, and this administration shouldn't be surprised when we do.
Oh, me too.
Well,
Sherry,
that's
a very good way to end our conversation. Sherry Swakowsky, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Retired Army Colonel, served as the Human Resource Director for the Wisconsin National Guard, currently says a member of the Wisconsin ACLU Board of Directors, Vice Chair of the Fair Wisconsin Education Fund. And Heath Fogg Davis, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, again a member of the Philadelphia Mayoral LGBT Affairs Committee, and his book is called Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? Thanks very much for joining us, both of you, today on Radio Times. Well, Eric Prince, the ex-CEO of Blackwater USA, the private security company that's now called Academy, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about a plan to end the war in Afghanistan by installing an American viceroy to lead U.S. and coalition forces who would report to the U.S. president and use private military units. Our guest, Sean McFate, wrote a critical response in The Atlantic about the slippery slope of military mercenaries. He was a military contractor working in Africa, also was a paratrooper in the U.S. Army. He's currently a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, professor of strategy at the National Defense University and Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He's written a couple of books. He's got a new novel upcoming called Deep Black, and he joins us on Radio Times. Sean McVeigh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's so good to be here, Marty.
What's the contrast? Because you've worked both as a military contractor and also as you were a paratrooper in the U.S. Army. How different were your rules of engagement, even your responsibilities?
It's vastly different. You know, being a soldier in the U.S. Army and being a private military contractor, which, you know, many would call mercenary, totally different. I mean, one of the world of contracting is actually largely mysterious to Americans. They can do a lot of great things, but sometimes they're hired to do things that you don't want your soldiers to do.
And that's the difference, you think, going off contract?
Well, it's very easy to go rogue in it. Going off contract means you're kind of going rogue. Most of the military contractors that the U.S. hired in Iraq and Afghanistan, well, most of them were they didn't do that. But I worked in Africa, and there were many opportunities to do so. Mm-hmm. And now we're living in a world that's post-American Iraq, post-America Afghanistan, and this industry is actually flourishing all over the world right now.
In fact, you say the ratio of U.S. military to contractors today in the U.S. is 1-1. Do I have that right?
Well, in the
in
war,
war zone,
Iraq,
in war zones,
the
yes,
war, yeah, in the war zones, there was a 1-1 ratio. For every trooper, there was a contractor. Now, just to be clear, most of those contractors were not armed; they were just cooking food and repairing trucks. But we've grown over the air. I mean, can you imagine, like 30 years ago, thinking that we would actually have armed contractors fighting next to soldiers and Marines? That's what we've come to.
And why is that?
The reason is simple, is that, you know, when the Iraq war started, as your listeners will recall, they thought the war would be done in, I think one said days, weeks at the most, not months. And, of course, it lasted, you know, for 15 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they had three ugly choices, the policymakers. They could either withdraw and cede the battlefield to terrorists. They could have a Vietnam draft to fill the ranks of an all-volunteer force that couldn't find enough volunteers, or they can make up the difference with contractors. And both Democrats and Republican White Houses tend to make up the difference with contractors.
The reason we have you on the show is we read your piece in The Atlantic, The Blackwater 2.0 Plan for Afghanistan. And I quoted just a couple of things that Eric Prince talked about in his Wall Street Journal op-ed. What is your main argument against this idea of not just a viceroy in Afghanistan, but the use of military contractors?
Yeah, so Eric Prince, who's the founder of Blackwater, is floating this idea in Washington that's being championed by Steve Bannon and some others of, you know, we can, quote, fix, unquote, Afghanistan by having an American viceroy to rule over it. And he would or she would have mercenary armies. And he actually uses, you know, British colonial examples of how to do this. Like, that, you know, you can imagine the British imperialism in India in the 19th century. And I can't, first of all, I cannot think of anything more deeply un-American than having America becoming a colonialist-like power in Afghanistan. And the second, this is extraordinarily dangerous. I mean, if you create a mercenary army, assuming you could even do that in Afghanistan, who's to say that the Pakistan's ISI wouldn't, like, buy it out from under you, or it couldn't go into business for itself, becoming essentially the biggest warlord in Afghanistan and spreading to neighbors? I mean, it's funny because mercenaries, they're not like national armies. They are market actors, and they look for profits, and they can start and elongate wars for profit. So as a former military contractor myself, I cannot think of a worse solution for Afghanistan.
Is it a matter, and how serious is the lobbying going on? And this, as you said, this is something that Stephen Bannon and Jared Kushner are interested in. Is the military, is the Pentagon interested in this?
Well, I'm based in Washington, and my sources in the Pentagon and others, you know, this was dead in arrival by all the generals from, you know, Mr. Mattis and General Dunford to General H.R. McMaster in the White House. But however, that doesn't mean it doesn't have, airlift in this administration, in this town these days. So something that would have been simply a chuckle 2 or 3 years ago or even 10 years ago is still in play. So I think there is some concern that this is not exactly over.
I would assume the Pentagon doesn't necessarily want to give up control over military operations in places like Afghanistan.
No, I mean, this is, again, contrary to the very culture and mission of our military. Second, if Trump is looking for out-of-the-box solutions, for which this certainly qualifies, I think also the military wouldn't want to see this because it would show a lack of confidence in the president in the military to continue this war.
And this notion of a viceroy, where does that come from? I mean, and it looks like there's something about MacArthur, the occupation of Japan. Obviously, Prince is looking at some of the past uses of the military.
Yeah, so he uses the term viceroy, which in colonial era times meant like basically the monarch, the imperial overlord, squashing the sovereignty of Afghanistan, which we've been fighting for the last 16 years. He uses MacArthur. MacArthur, after Japan went in there, sort of was the proconsul or viceroy, but that was a different situation. And we can't forget that MacArthur was fired for abuse of power. This person would report directly to the president. And, during an interview I did with Eric Prince, he kind of walked back his position from the op-ed and said, you got to think about it like he would say, Afghanistan's bankrupt, and this is like a bankruptcy lawyer telling you what to do. Well, that's not how international relations works. So there's a lot of problems with this.
That's Sean McFadyen. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, former military contractor and Army paratrooper. We're talking about the risks of relying on mercenaries in overseas wars and conflicts, something he wrote about in a recent edition of The Atlantic. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. Much more after this very short break. This is Radio Times. Would handing over military operations in Afghanistan to private contractors and a viceroy end this country's longest war? Eric Prince, former head of Blackwater, has a plan. Our guest, Sean McFadyen, says not so fast. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a professor of strategy at the National Defense University and Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He has worked as a private military contractor in Africa, also an Army paratrooper, written a couple of books, including a couple of novels, including a new one called Deep Black. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. It seems to me, though, that we already have at least contractors and U.S. military working together in hot spots, wars, conflict zones around the world. I mean, it seems like this is just how we do things now.
It is. And what it's not just an American thing. We're seeing mercenaries. We're seeing Putin hire mercenaries in both Ukraine and Syria. We're seeing Abu Dhabi hire mercenaries to fight in Yemen. We've seen Nigeria hire mercenaries to push out Boko Haram. I don't know if you know the African jihadi group who kidnapped 300 girls. And the story about that is that the Nigerian military, which is a strong military for Africa, for 6 years could not deal with Boko Haram. In 2015, the Nigerian military secretly hired mercenaries, and they pushed them out in weeks. And it got a lot of other people around the world thinking, well, why couldn't we do that against al-Shabaab or ISIS? And so we're seeing the resurrection of mercenaries around the world as we speak.
Do we know how they were able to push out Boko Haram in weeks versus years?
Yeah, we do, a little bit. So again, from what I know on the ground is that when we think of mercenaries, you think of like these lone guys with AK-47 showing up for a payday. That's not actually how the world of mercenaries works today. They incorporate, they are big organizations, and they show up with attack helicopters and special forces teams. And that's how they pushed out Boko Haram.
You served as a military contractor. When you looked at the people you served with, how many were Americans?
Very few. Actually, most people don't know is that a lot of these contractors are non-American. They come from all over the world. So when I was working in Africa, and I had colleagues working in Iraq and Afghanistan, you had contractors from El Salvador, the Philippines. You had them from Ghana, Africa, from everywhere.
And the pay? How does that compare?
The pay was about double my army salary, which is not that great for what you're doing, because if you get hurt, you're on your own. And it's even cheaper for if you come from like the Philippines. They kind of give you Philippine rates, unfortunately, or fortunately. Contractors are cheaper, which is why the military, the Pentagon, likes to use them. But this is now, again, it's proliferating around the world because of this diversity.
Yeah. I don't want to make too much of this, but we have certainly Afghanistan, a perfect example of a war, at least it seems, without end. Do you think having mercenaries or contractors and companies in it to make money leads to longer wars?
I do. I do. You know, if you think about the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about, you know, that was all about making products like airplanes and ships. Now it's about providing services, including trigger pulling services. I suspect that Eric Prince wrote that op-ed because he's, you know, lobbying for a job. I think also is that, you know, the thing about contractors and mercenaries is that they offer plausible deniability. So when you want what they call a zero footprint operation, you hire mercenaries. You wouldn't have the SEALs or the CIA do it because if they get captured or hurt, you've got to rescue them. Contractors are what they call kite missions. If they get in trouble, you just cut them away.
In fact, you say more contractors killed in combat these days than soldiers.
Yeah. So in the beginning of the Iraq and Afghanistan war, U.S. troops were mostly KIAs. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of those wars, it was mostly contractors, which tells you how much we rely on contractors.
But when we're talking about the numbers of Marines and soldiers in combat, are contractors not counted in that?
No, and that's the reason why I think White Houses of all stripes likes them, because they don't count as boots on the ground, nor do they count as casualties.
In fact, I was thinking about President Obama talking about a light footprint when it came to withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan.
Yeah, so what happened is that they reduce the number of troops, but they, you know, double the number of contractors. And nobody tracks that. And also, there's no American body bags coming home because most of those contractors are not even American.
Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We are talking about the reliance on military mercenaries or contractors more and more. And I guess Sean McFate worked both as a military contractor and served as a paratrooper in the U.S. Army. Let me get Linda from Princeton to join us. Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty, and to your guests. I have a quick comment and then a question. I knew that things were rather heartless to begin with from the beginning of the Iraq invasion, vis-a-vis the impact on civilians and our own troops. The question or the phrase, they were expendable, really seems to be the theme of the hour here. Not only have civilians been expendable to a large degree, but now these contractors, from what your guests just said, they don't come back in body bags. The public is largely unaware of them. My question is, would you believe the contractors nowadays under this kind of plan, would they be more or less susceptible to the law than they have been historically?
Linda, thanks for the call to Radio
Thank
Times.
You.
Sure, yeah, go ahead, Sean.
So that's a great question. So one reason why I think countries, not just ours, other countries like contractors, is that they are non-people. They get, you know, if a contractor gets injured, nobody cares. They get sent home. We, in this country, we don't mourn the death of contractors the way we mourn the death of soldiers. And I don't see that's going to change. In terms of law, international law does not solve this problem. And here's the reason why. We have a lot of examples of this historically in the Middle Ages. Who's going to go in and arrest those mercenaries in Nigeria? You know, who's going to send the Marine Corps after them? Also, those mercenaries can shoot your law enforcement dead. And we've gotten to a point now that, you know, the proverbial genie's out of the bottle. And this is like one of the largest and secret trends of international insecurity of this century that nobody's paying attention to, which worries me. Because we're going to get to a point where, like, anybody who's rich enough can hire or rent an army. Like, oil companies can have armies in a couple decades, and that will change international relations as we know it.
But are we saying that there's a difference between a contractor or a mercenary because they are in it for the money versus a soldier or marine in it, you know, for what we call God and country?
Well, that's a great question. So I was in the industry for several years, and I wanted to write about it. I wanted to write initially a memoir about, you know, because people have no idea what this shadowy world looks like, and I want to pull back the curtain on this. And my agent was like, no. If you write that, you're going to be sued to death. So we fictionalized it, and we turned it into a novel, which is mostly true. I have a novel coming out called Deep Black, which shows a mercenary team going into the ISIS caliphate, based on actual reporting of people I know in D.C., that sort of shows the complexity, because not all mercenaries and not all contractors are in it for the money, just like not all soldiers are in it for, you know, God and country.
Right.
So I think the difference, though, between a mercenary and a soldier ultimately is that the mercenary has, you know, free choice and freedom to make decisions about what causes they want to fight and what causes they don't. And there are villainous mercenaries who can do great harm, and there also can be heroic ones too.
I can imagine, though, someone thinking that whatever the mercenaries did to Boko Haram, they deserved it, or whatever is being done to ISIS by mercenaries, they deserved it too.
Yeah, and, you know, if you think about it, mercenaries are the second oldest profession in the world. Most of military history is private military history. They are like fire. Harnessed well, they can power a steam engine. But used recklessly, they can burn down your house and the city. And we've seen examples of both historically.
I'm thinking of Blackwater, I guess it was in Baghdad, right, early on in the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 2007, a Blackwater contractor squad killed 17 innocent people at a place called Nisour Square in Baghdad. And it was very controversial because all the thing that happened to them as they got sent home, they were fired. Had soldiers done that, they would have been court-martialed. And one of the biggest problems about contractors and mercenaries, per Linda's comment, is how do you regulate them? How do you control them? How do you have accountability and transparency? And that remains core to this day.
Let me get to another caller. This is John from Haddonfield joining us on Radio Times. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure, no problem.
With regard to control of the mercenary population, it seems like a lot of the focus has been on their actions in field. But one of the is the fact that a mercenary force requires no congressional oversight or authorization. In 2013, when Barack Obama sought congressional authorization for use of force in Syria, I think it was, you know, he really couldn't get any Republican support, and there was not very strong Democratic support for that, and that prevented it. But what's to prevent this president, who does not have broad mandates for anything like military action, or a future president from utilizing mercenaries as a politically risk-free way to execute whatever personal issues he may have or to accumulate political capital without having to obtain Democratic oversight or the buy-in of the population?
John, it's a great question. Go ahead, Sean.
So, John, that's a great question. Well, first of all, using contractors kind of circumvents the whole democratic accountability of the armed forces, because there's no reporting requirement really for them. It's not like there's congressional hearings it's not like, you know, the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff have to go to Congress and report. Also, if you're a researcher or a journalist, if you can do a Freedom of Information Act request for the Department of Defense, the CIA, no such thing with contractors. They hide behind what they call proprietary knowledge, and they have a very liberal understanding of proprietary. Everything is proprietary for them. which makes them kind of ideal to do plausible deniability operations, because that is more important than firepower today. We live in an age of, you know, an information age. Being able to use, you know, to deny operations is a big deal. And the CIA could go to these companies and say, we want you to do something crazy, and it would be clandestine. But it's not just our country, it's every country that's looking at this as well, every rich country. And so that's what's helping proliferate this slow rise of mercenaries around the world today.
You've been writing a lot about this, and in one of the pieces you wrote, you call for an American Foreign Legion fashioned on the French Foreign Legion. How would that work, and how would it solve some of the issues you've just been describing?
Yeah, so we live in a weird situation where we have a military that's not, you know, it's an all-volunteer force that can't be everywhere to do all the missions we want it to do without burning out. And then we have, like, the Eric Prince model, which is, like, let's just hire a huge mercenary army and see what happens, which is like, one step away from a nuclear bomb, if you ask me. So what I decided to do is propose this idea of a, you know, the French Foreign Legion is actually not a mercenary outfit. That's run, it's part of the French army. It answers only to Paris. It's run by French officers, but it's enlisted come from all over the world who come and because they want to serve with France. They work to citizenship after 10 years. And something like that could be very useful for us because we can have an enduring presence in places that we want to be without having a national draft or a huge military or rely on contractors who ultimately don't have, you know, we have more regulation for the manufacture of toys than for the outsourcing of firepower. If we had at least an American Foreign Legion under Pentagon command, it would have to answer to a military law, which they don't have to do right now.
Almost out of time here. This is a out of left field question for you, but I was reading a bit about you. You are an opera fan, yes?
I love opera, yeah.
You love opera. Why do you love opera?
Well, you know, I grew up actually as a violinist. I was going to be a violinist. And then I had a midlife crisis at age 13 where I realized no matter how much I practiced, I'd never be Yasha Heifetz. So I put it down and walked away from the violin, but I've always retained my passion for opera. And in some ways, it really, the light of opera really offsets some of the darkness I experienced in Africa as a contractor.
I read you relied on Puccini's Tosca for perspective as you trained Tutsis and Hutus, genocide arrivals in 1994 to become a credible military unit in 2004. Reading from the Herald Tribune here.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Puccini, it's also, you know, Mahler and everybody else. But, you know, it's, you know, it's sort of like when I went out to Africa, I sort of channeled or found my inner Joseph Conrad. Huh. And you need something to balance yourself so you don't become a wasted soul.
We're almost out of time here, and obviously Eric Prince got a fair amount of interest and coverage. How about your critical response to him? What's been the response to that?
It's gotten a lot of interest as well. The reason that's interesting for me is that I, like him, have been in this world a lot. And I also have been a soldier like him. And so he's kind of dismissive of those who are just pure academics or not ex-soldiers. Not so much with me. So my concern, of course, is that he's very politically connected. His sister is Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education. And like I said, the whole Bannon wing of this White House seems interested in his ideas. And that's something we should all take very seriously.
Well, Sean McVeigh, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Appreciate it.
No problem. Senior fellow with the Atlantic Council, professor of strategy at the National Defense University and Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and his newest novel called Deep Black. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. Yes, it is Friday. I was up late last night. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.